there's some value in thinking about developing your code within a programming framework such as Cactus. And so a framework is essentially provides a paradigm for scientific software development, in which instead of writing a program in some programming language, one instead writes modules within some framework. And it has many benefits for collaboration and so forth, which I'll talk a bit about today. So I'll start off with some historical motivation for why one might want to do such a thing. Then I'll give a few details about the Cactus framework, and then I'll describe some results from three different communities for which there's modules within the Cactus framework, which allows one to do to get results from various simulations. Let me mention that I'm not going to go into a whole lot of detail about any of these topics, so I won't go into a lot of detail about Cactus and the particular things it provides and so forth. I just want to give some general idea of why it's useful to think about software development in this way. Okay, so some history. So in general, when you're thinking about embarking on some project in scientific computing, the goal is to get a paper published, or maybe a number of papers. And when you're first starting, then so you might start writing a program. So when I was a student, I started writing a program in C, I think. And when starting new projects, I'd often just cut and paste pieces of code from other things that I had developed. And I'd debug it until it starts giving correct answers. And eventually, I end up with some very large monolithic piece of code written in some programming language. And after I do this for a number of different projects, then I have a whole bunch of these large codes. And what happens is they start to become unwieldy. And so, in particular, one thing that is useful to be able to do is to share code with collaborators. So oftentimes, you want to work with someone else. That person may be an expert in some particular aspect of the problem, which I'm not an expert, but it's useful to have code that works together in some way. And so I started thinking about how can I share my code with my collaborators. So some other reasons that you might want to share code is that if you have a student, say, and that student is very good at some maybe programming or something, and they develop some very efficient software to perform some task, it'd be useful to take advantage of that code even after they leave. And likewise, one can, you may have a colleague that's very good at coding GPUs or something like this. It's useful to be able to take advantage of that expertise. However, these monolithic codes are very difficult to share. So in general, a code that if you don't spend a lot of time thinking about how to make it accessible to others, it tends to be opaque. It's just written in some very particular detailed way in a specific programming language. If you hand it to someone else and suggest that they change, the program does X, and you suggest, well, can you make it do Y, which is similar to X? That's often a very difficult problem for anyone but the person who wrote the code initially. And so the first thing I tried was putting my code into a library. I implemented my code for working with causal sets, which are partially ordered sets, into a C++ library. And that went part of the way, but it wasn't quite enough in practice. So one of the major flaws of a library is that it tends to be language specific. So that in order to use the library, one has to more or less be able to program in a particular language that the library expressed in. Another limitation of libraries is that the interface that's required to use them is very specific. It's expressed as argument lists of functions usually, and these argument lists are very detailed lists. There's a particular order of the arguments. That's generally more detailed than one wants to have to learn. And then also the user of the library still has to write a main routine and call the functions in the library. Even if the library does everything that you want it to do, the user still has to write a routine and debug it in order to make use of that code. And lastly, it's not symmetric, so it's easy for one person maybe to share their code by writing the library, but then it doesn't allow the other person to also share their code, unless maybe they write another library. So now I'll switch to saying a few words about the Binary Black Hole Grand Challenge. So this was a very large project which was initiated in the United States in the 1990s, where there was a large grant was provided to form a collaboration, a very large collaboration, to try to solve the binary black hole problem. And so one of the challenges that they faced was this very problem of how do we generate, how can we collaborate? So you have many groups here, they have different specialties, but how can you get them all to collaborate on the same code base? And in practice, I think it was quite difficult. I remember a long meeting, trying to decide what exactly should be the argument list for some Fortran function, because in order for to build the community code, they had to agree on such details. And so it was difficult to do. So out of this difficulty was born the Pectus framework. So this is a piece of software which was developed at NCSA in response to this very problem by a number of people. Yes?
The problem wasn't solved
by okay. So,
security fundamental issues about Einstein's equations. The other ones were more about computational infrastructure and even just computational hardware itself. So the problem got solved 6 years later, in part by people working really hard and France trying some new path, but also just being able to, well, the community did solve these issues at the mathematical level, and then the computer power caught up to the point that now you can, of the few options that you have that could probably be the right ones, you could then do tests within a human time. That is, you could try something and within a week, you could kind of find more finely tuned and then just use a Darwin approach to guide you in the right direction. That's how the problem got solved.
Another issue is that one says the binary black hole problem is solved, but that's not, doesn't mean that no one is interested in that anymore. That means nowadays one can calculate spacetimes containing binary black holes using codes such as Cactus or many other codes exist to do the same thing. I mean, building on this infrastructure, people can now solve it. So I think the expression, it has been solved, that implies no one's interested in it anymore. And that is actually wrong. It's still at the heart of doing other things, adding more physics to black holes, as you suspect.
Yes. And I also want to say that it illustrates a problem of how to write software that's collaborative in a sense, that allows large collaborations to work together. And so this is a particular problem that I want to argue that you could think of Cactus as addressing. So the basic idea is that the code is composed as a collection of modules. And the interoperability of these modules is enabled by the Cactus flesh. So the framework itself is make sure that the various modules can work together. And so this greatly simplifies the task of code sharing, because now instead of all working on the same particular code, each person writes a module within this framework, and the framework takes care of making sure the modules can speak to each other. And so this is more general than a library, and I claim more effective. So one of the great benefits of the Cactus framework is that it provides a degree of language independence. So now the collaboration doesn't have to agree on a language. The idea is each person can program in their own favorite language. And then the APIs, the programming interface that they have to agree upon is expressed in the language of the framework rather than in the language of some particular programming language. Another thing it offers is portability. It auto-detects many things about a machine that you're running on, so it's somewhat easy to port Cactus to a new machine that becomes available. Another advantage is that it simplifies the use of high-performance computing hardware, so one can write modules which, to a degree, can provide automatic parallelism and things such as this. So it's somewhat unique in that it provides, there's a focus in the design on performance. Furthermore, it has built-in regression testing, so if somebody changes a piece of the code, then you can find out about that it's giving different answers pretty quickly. And so the idea is then that one can build up a community toolkit by writing modules within a framework such as Cactus. And so now, the last second half of my talk, I'll just say, give some results from various computations that have been done within Cactus. I'll start by saying some things about the computations of the volume spectrum in loop quantum gravity that I've done with Johannes Brüneman. So loop quantum gravity is expressed in terms of a spin network, which is a graph which is embedded in the three-dimensional manifold. And you might, in order to understand the dynamics of the theory, a first step is to understand the behavior of the volume operator. The volume operator is some expression which operates on a vertex of this embedded graph. And it's given as so. One aspect of this operator, which hasn't been studied in too much detail because it's difficult to address analytically, is these epsilon ijk. These are signs, plus or minus one or zero, which appear in the expression. For each triple of these are edge tangent vectors at a vertex. For each triple of edge tangent vectors, we get a sign. And these signs appear in the expression for the volume, like so. So one thing that the computer allows is a somewhat generic analysis of the spectrum of the volume operator by just finding what are all the possible signs that we can realize for an embedding into a three-dimensional space. And it turns out one of these assignments of signs for every triple of three vectors is what's called a chirotope in the literature of oriented matroids. And so we looked at the full spectrum of the operator on a generic vertex. We looked at, so on the edges of the spin network are representations of SU2 identified by a spin. And so we looked at all spins up to some maximum for valences 4 through 7, and all chirotopes. All chirotopes that don't have a triple of coplanar edges. And so if we look at the spectrum of the volume for each chirotope, each assignment of signs, then we get some histogram like so. What's of particular interest is if we look at the smallest non-zero eigenvalues. So it turns out that, so this is a plot, sigma index identifies one of these chirotopes. J max is the maximum spin on an edge, and the vertical is the eigenvalue, the smallest non-zero eigenvalue. It turns out that for almost every chirotope, the smallest non-zero eigenvalue decreases with spin. And so this means that there's no smallest non-zero eigenvalue in the theory. So in this sense, it shows that the loop quantum gravity is not discrete. The volume of volumes given by the theory are not discrete. The next thing I want to talk about is causal sets. So there's two things in particular I wanted to mention. One involves the growth dynamics for causal sets. So a causal set is a partially ordered set which is locally finite. So it's a set of elements with a partial order relation defined on it, which is transitive and acyclic. So you can identify one by a picture like on the left, Hasse diagram, where each dot is an element of the causal set, and each line is a, represents a relation in a partial order. And so one can write down a dynamical law for causal sets, this classical sequential growth dynamics, which is based a rule for stochastic growth of the causal set, which depends upon some physically motivated conditions. In some sense, generically, it gives rise to this particular behavior where generically the causal set will develop elements which are related to every other element of the causal set. And the universe is born from one of those elements and it grows exponentially. And so with Maqbul Ahmed, we've studied the behavior of the one of these regions of the causal set early universe and find something that has bears a striking resemblance with 3 plus 1 dimensional Cassiter spacetime. Yeah, pardon me. Okay. So in particular, if one looks at the an order interval, so if you take a pair of elements in the causal set and look at the number of other elements that are in between it, that the number of elements should be proportional to the spacetime volume in De Sitter spacetime. And so on the right here, we've plotted the, for a given length of the longest chain of one of these order intervals, if you look at the largest cardinality of one of these order intervals that appears in the causal set, and plot that against L, it turns out to match very closely what one would expect from the analogous computation in 3 plus 1 dimensional De Sitter spacetime. Okay, so the input is so the input of this growth dynamics is two principles. One is covariance, a discrete analog of general covariance. And the other is a causality condition. Well, so Minkowski is a special case of De Sitter. So, likewise. So why is it positive and not negative? So I'm not sure. That's not entirely clear why it's picking up positive. Yes, that's another curiosity. It's, that happened to fit. So we tried every possible dimension for De Sitter spacetime, up to 9 or so. And it just happened I haven't given the details here, but for a large enough causal set, which corresponds to a small enough parameter which describes this growth process. So the growth process, in particular, can be described very simply. The new element, for each new element that appears, it looks at each existing element and it connects to it with a fixed probability P. And so you can imagine if the value of P is very small, then the universe will grow more rapidly. And so if P is small enough, then it turns out to fit 3 plus 1 dimensional De Sitter best. Okay. The other results I wanted to mention about in the context of causal sets involves evaluation of the behavior of a free scalar field on a interval in Minkowski spacetime. So if you take an order interval in Minkowski spacetime and look at a causal set representation of the order interval, then it turns out that Raphael and Stephen Johnston have formulated a field theory for a free scalar field living on such a causal set. And so I've written code in Cactus to evaluate the Whiteman function for such a scalar field. On the left is a plot of the Whiteman function for space-like and space-like and time-like related elements in the causal set as a function of proper distance between them. And what we can see is that the results very closely match that of a continuum theory. And on the right is a plot made by Yasuman, which compares the behavior of the Whiteman function in for the causal set with that of three continuum theories of the scalar field. On the top is of I can't read it from here. The top is Rindler, the middle is a mirror, space-time, and the bottom is Minkowski. And some preliminary results indicate it seems to be matching. So this is a plot of the Whiteman function, which is given by the causal set, versus what would it be given by the continuum theory. So if this is a straight line, then it should be then the discrete theory is matching the continuum. And the best match appears to be occurring for the mirror space-time. So that's another result. And then I wanted to finish just saying some words about the coastal modeling framework. So I've developed what's called a driver in practice, which implements a very general specification for unstructured meshes. And this just describes an example of what it would look like to define such an unstructured mesh. The point is that the definition is general enough that one can describe all sorts of different discrete structures with the specification. And with some colleagues at CCT, we implemented a parallel high-order discontinuous Clairton shallow water model using this driver. And this is an example of some of the output. And so in conclusion, I just want to mention again that I want to argue that the use of a framework can lead to greater overall productivity in the long term, even if that particular moment that you started a project, you seem small, and maybe it's not worth the trouble to learn the framework. I want to argue that it may be worthwhile. For example, the time to learn a framework is much smaller than the time to learn a programming language, and since you're working on it already, then clearly you spent the time to learn the language, so it might be worthwhile to spend a little bit more time to learn a framework as well. Okay, thank you.